And you're on. Hi, I'm Jack.
Jack!
For those of you that are clock watchers, I refer you to your schedule, and it says we can be here until 10, because that's the next thing on your schedule is free time at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
And the gentleman said we can go as long as we want, so you can give up watching the clock. And now I know what it's like to come in relief in the seventh inning after a perfect game up until now. Thanks, Willie. Jeez. So I'm going to open with a knuckleball. Are you ready? I was down in Louisiana talking at a conference. The people that were there are some giants in AA. One of them was Sandy Beach, one of the most eloquent people I ever met. I was privileged to spend a great deal of time with Sandy. And there was a lady named Deb H. out of North Carolina. And over the course of the weekend, them and some other people that whose names you might recognize were doing a series of workshops. We were doing workshops all weekend long, steps, traditions, relationships, spirituality. It was this whole menu of stuff, and they were going round and round and round the clock. And the lunch thing happened to be like a cafeteria-style thing that when you wanted to go eat, you got in a line, you went up through the cafeteria and got your food and sat down. It was like everything was really based around the workshops. And nobody really knows me. I haven't spoken yet. I haven't done any workshops yet. I like that kind of anonymity when you first get there. They don't put you up on a pedestal too much. You're just another Joe, maybe in a tie or whatever. And I'm standing in line behind these two young ladies who are clearly here looking for Mr. Wright. They're all eyeballs and cleavage and long dresses and high heels and smoochy paint, and they're waiting. They're only there killing time until the 13-step dance later tonight, right? And I overhear them talking about the workshops, and the one woman is telling the other one, you know, it was so exciting to hear Sandy talking about steps one and two, and there are all of these people doing all these workshops, but then they do those traditions, and they're just so dry. I'm standing right behind him, and I said, did you know that those things could get you laid? They both turned into Linda Blair. Their heads did like a 360 on their shoulder, and you can't turn around. They said, what, really? And I said, yes. They said, how? I said, you'll have to come to the traditions workshop later today. That was my knuckleball. So my wife, when she got sober in 1988, I believe she would have been dead within a year. She was a late-stage alcoholic. Women don't hold up under that kind of level of infirmity under the lash of alcoholism, and I think it would have killed her pretty soon. She got sober against all odds. Everybody was betting against her, including her sponsor. My wife asked her sponsor if she would work with her, and her sponsor replied, oh, honey, I don't sponsor losers. We've been talking about it. I don't sponsor losers, but you can call me. And then after a year of sobriety, my wife went back to her and said, will you sponsor me now? And Pat said, well, okay, but let's don't tell anybody just yet. So my wife goes to this woman. She's been to enough meetings. She understands that the nature of what we do around here is we work a program. The program is embodied in the 12 steps, which we got from Alcoholics Anonymous. And she went to her sponsor, Pat, who is in charge of saving her life. There's no other description that fits that relationship. That woman is responsible for saving my wife's life. And she said, I'm ready to work the steps now. And Pat said to her, and I've never, ever heard this in probably 3,000 open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's a conservative number. I've always gone to open AA meetings. And she said, oh, honey, you're so not ready to work the steps. You do not work and play well with others. You're going to work the traditions first. This was towards the end of 1988 in very new sobriety. She had a couple of months. I've never, ever heard a speaker say that they went to their sponsor and said, I'm ready to do the steps now. And their sponsor said, oh, you're not ready. Or that they suggested as an alternative that you do the traditions. So the ideas and the concepts of these traditions began to come into my home 18 months before I darkened the door of my first Al-Anon meeting. I did not know what they were, but I began to reap the benefits of those ideas being implemented in my home, and I didn't know what they were. The 12 steps, which I take very seriously, and I did them with a sponsor. I've taken an awful lot of people through the steps the way that I was taught to do it, performed a very limited function for me. They made me, for the first time ever, a circumstance that had never occurred before, I was right-sized with me and right-sized with God. That was it. I had never been right-sized with myself. I had always had a distorted view of who I was, and I was terrified that you would figure out who I was and throw me away. Mm. That's the view I had of me. And I've got no relationship with God. I put God in the ground with my daughter when I buried her in 1977 and swore never to go back and see either one of them. I went back and stood on my daughter's grave and made an amends to both of them 14 years later. But what the traditions did and what they do in my home and in my life is, for the first time, I begin to be right-sized with you, right-sized with my wife, right-sized with the full shopping cart and the 15 items or less line at the market, mm-hmm. right? That being right-sized with anybody else on the planet was never, it was always, I was way up here or I was way down there and afraid you'd find out. I was never right-sized. And the moral of the story is that if you figure out how to be right-sized in your relationship and in my marriage, and this is the end of the talk before the beginning, for the first time in my house when we began to be the same size as each other and everybody had full citizenship, levels of friendship, communication, trust, sex, partnership began to happen that had never existed before in a world where the only relationships ever modeled for me in my heavily alcoholic family were relationships based on power, based on getting power, not losing power, causing other people to lose power. Every relationship that was modeled for me was that. Mom and dad, case in point. Dad trying to figure out how to get away with stuff and mom not know. He's got a wad of bills in his pocket and my mom's trying to figure out, she knows he's got money, trying to figure out how to get it. Everybody jockeying for power in the relationship and in the house. I had no other models for that. The first models for that came out of the application of these traditions. I want to tell a quick story about how they were adopted. Willie alluded to the idea that Bill came up with them, and it was true that people would call up. You know, Bill was afraid that the fellowship would dry up and blow away if something happened to him. Dr. Bob's already getting sick. He was to die a year after the conference in 1950 where they adopted these traditions, and he knew the handwriting was on the wall that if he went and Bob went, there was nobody to run, nobody in charge of the asylum, and he was afraid that they would lose it. So he formulated the ideas of these traditions, which were already in the big book in the front, and he gelled them into the 12 traditions, and then began sharing about them everywhere. And they'd say, Bill, would you come share at our meeting? Man, you want to have the founder come and share at your meeting? And he'd say, I'd be delighted. And they'd say, Bill, don't come down here and talk about those damn traditions. And Bill would say, okay. And he would go to the meeting and talk about the traditions because he was terrified that the fellowship would unless he could turn the fellowship over to itself, it would fly away. So at the 1950 AA International, Bill is still the guy. He's the chief operating officer of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's running the conference. Over the course of the weekend, he has a couple of guys get up sporadically through the schedule, and they would share on a couple of the traditions, and they'd sit back down. So at six different points in the schedule, he brought these guys up to share about it. And he knew that this was a controversial idea in AA. He also knew that if he let you guys talk about it long enough, you'd talk it to death and go home and think about it in 5 years at the next conference. So after those 12 guys got up and shared about the 12 traditions, at the end of the conference, Bill Wilson said, you've all heard the traditions as read. There being no objection, they are adopted as read. And he banged a gavel and everybody went, what? It was the greatest manipulation, probably the biggest first Al-Anon slip in the history of man, because he was terrified that they wouldn't be adopted by the conference. And that was in 1950. So tradition one. Our common welfare should come first. Personal progress for the greatest number depends upon unity. And I'm bringing this home in a hard and fast. I mean, you're going to be heads nodding right here. When I've got two of my three children are alcoholic. The third one is severely mentally compromised because of alcoholism and her mother and presented her own special challenges. And all three of those kids at one time or another went on the street. The two that are alcoholic met like a decade apart, said, F you, I'm out of here, and went on the street. My daughter, and this is a case in point, was stealing from other members of the house to feed her addiction. At the time, it was internet and social media stuff, and she was stealing other people's devices, and it was really bad in the house. Nothing was safe. I got everything locked up. And she said, F you, I'm out of here, and she was on the street overnight and came back and said, I'd like to come back. And I said, well, this is a new tenancy. There's new rules. What do you mean there's new rules? You don't live here now. We're negotiating for what's going to look like if you live here going forward. I see the heads nodding already. And I said, here's the rules. And I laid them all out. And among them was, you may not steal from anybody else in the house. And I said, any violation of any of these terms of this contract is grounds for immediate termination of your tenancy. And she agreed to it. She was there for about 2 weeks. I caught her. She stole some stuff out of my office, out of a place that I had things put away so she couldn't get to them. And she was back online. And I went in and I called her on it. And she had a fit and then stole some more stuff. And I had to go to my little girl. And I did not do this with any vitriol whatsoever. I was not angry. I said, honey, you violated the contract. You got to go. And she says, what do you mean? I says, darling, it's none of our business what you do. But what I know is that you just can't do it here. Our common welfare as a family and as household has to come first. It was the same decision we had made probably 15 years before that with my son. I was gone on the road working on a show. My wife called me up. We're a recovering house. We've made amends to him. We've all done the steps in there. And he became violent with my wife and stole some things out of the house. And she called me in a panic. And she said, what do we do? I said, that's easy. You call old man Stokes down in San Fernando, have him come change the locks on the house. Common welfare, my son's presence in the house and the behavior he was doing compromised our common welfare. My daughter's behavior in stealing things from the household compromised our common welfare. How's that for taking this stuff home? If you sit in a meeting and they read the steps and they read, you know, understanding ourselves and they're reading all the stuff and they get to the traditions and your eyeballs glaze over, I beg to differ with how important these things are. And I really like to hear them read at every meeting. Tradition two, for our group purpose, there is but one authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Here's what a group conscience looked like in my house. She's been the bad little girl and I've been the mad dad for a long time. She's a hope to die blackout alcoholic and she's in trouble every day. She's in trouble for crap she doesn't even know she did because she blacks out every night. She just has to assume because I'm angry in the morning, she must have done something wrong. And I have the illusion of power in the relationship because I believe I have the moral high ground. And so group conscience goes like this. I come up with an idea, or she does, we debate it. She's wrong for the good of the fellowship because I'm the loudest. I own the house when I met her. I own the business when I met her. I'm the principal breadwinner. I overrule her for the good, for the health of the family, the finances, or whatever, and make a decision. What does that look like in terms of being right size? It doesn't look like this. It looks like this. And we struggled with this for a long time. In early sobriety, we can't stand each other. So we fought about everything. We fought about money, finances, you name it, sex. We fought about everything. And we found a solution. We struggled with it for a while trying to apply this idea in our house because we want to have a group conscience, let God express himself through the conscience of the group. But how do you do that when there's two? How do you do that when one of them thinks they have veto power? You find that answer all the way up in the concepts of service. It's an idea called substantial unanimity. And what that means is that on the floor of our World Service Conference, if they have a very important issue on the floor, they agree before they take it on that unless the vote is unanimous or nearly unanimous, they agree to take no action. Boil that down to two people. We have an issue that we're talking about and we can't agree on what to do, then we agree not to take an action. Now, that doesn't always go your way. Bill Wilson said you need to exercise that responsibility with great caution because the shoe will soon be on the other foot. I've got an idea. I got this swinging deal on a new ski boat. A friend of mine's going to sell it. It's one I've always wanted, and the price is great. And she says, well, you know, last week you were telling me I couldn't go shopping because you didn't really have enough money in the bank and we got to wait for the next check to come in. I think that might mean we can't afford the boat. And I go, don't get my boat. But then the next week, her idea is, you know, I was thinking I might want to remodel the kitchen. And you find that democratic division of how those things works out has the end result of making everybody the same size in the relationship. Tradition three, The relatives of alcoholics, when gathered together for mutual aid, may call themselves an Al-Anon family group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. The only requirement for membership is that there be a problem of alcoholism in a relative or friend. The AA long form of the tradition says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism, hence we may refuse no one who wishes to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend on money or conformity. I'll give you an example of this with our meeting, and some of you go back far enough to remember. There was a time when we were back in the old rooms where we didn't have the giant wall of no anonymity in the back with all the glass on it, that we would have women show up. My first meeting at this group was a speaker meeting. There were women here. The second meeting I showed up, I've been sentenced to a men's stag meeting by my woman sponsor. I show up, and there's eight guys in the room, and a woman comes to the door just the meeting starts. She says, is this an Al-Anon meeting? And Pat, the founder of the meeting, got up, and my wife goes to women's stag meetings. I know what that looks like. Try crashing one of those. They'll find your hide drying on the wall next to the traditions tomorrow. I know what that looks like, or I think I know. So Pat walked over to the door, and I thought he was going to say, sorry, honey, this is a men's stag meeting, and there's a meeting down the street at the Touchdown Jesus Church. You go on down there. Pat said, ma'am, this is a men's stag Al-Anon meeting, but according to Tradition 5, which is jumping ahead, we're an Al-Anon meeting first. And if you'd like to join us, please feel free. She came in, we got her a cup of coffee. We had that happen more than 100 times over the years back in those rooms. Now they show up and look through the glass and they see 100 sperm donors wandering around in there and they don't come in. Once in a while you get one that's got the balls to come in and sit down. But in terms of my family, this tradition says I speak only for myself. I do not speak on behalf of my marriage or my partner. All right? I am not the voice of my family, and I'm not the authority. If you want, somebody says, well, if my wife is acting badly, that used to happen an awful lot, somebody would say, what's the matter with your wife? The proper answer when you think about this idea is, I don't know. You might have to ask her. All right? I'm not breaking her anonymity, and I'm not speaking on her behalf. Membership is always inclusive rather than exclusive. Just by way of this, I've had guys over the years, this happened several times, their wife is drinking, she's doing stuff, and he finally puts his foot down and puts her out, right? We don't generally talk about that first. There's other options besides just putting her out on the street, but they'll put her out. So she's out now. And they'll call me after a few weeks or a month or when the sperm starts to back up and say, thinking about letting her back in the house. And I ask him a very important question. If she comes back, is she coming back with full citizenship? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? That means full voice and full vote and all rights owed to anybody who's a citizen of the house. Or is she coming back so you can watch her? Or is she coming back so you can punish her again when she does it the next time? If she's coming back as a full citizen, let her back in. If she's not, do not let her back in the house. Tradition 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting another group or Al-Anon or AA as a whole. It says, I'm just going to read this because it's here. I'll just talk about this because it speaks to the idea in general. There was a guy in the early days of AA in Florida that was selling memberships in AA down in Florida. If you go back and look in the literature, you'll find references to it. This guy, word gets back to Bill, there's some goof down in Florida who's selling memberships in AA. And Bill decided that he really needed to look into this, and he corresponded with the guy, and he asked him, what are you doing selling memberships in AA? And the guy said, well, Bill, you don't understand. This is Florida. All these folks are old and retired. And if you tell them that AA is free and that they can have that seat anything they want, they might come or they might not. If you charge it for them, they come every week, he said. The only real governing factor in the meeting and in my marriage is who chooses to stay. I've been to meetings that operated pretty seriously afoul of the 12 traditions of Al-Anon gifted to us by Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in Baltimore, Maryland, and they had 5 meetings going on at the same time on the same day on Sunday mornings at Evergreen up at Loyola College. 3 AA meetings. There was more than that. There was like 5 Al-Anon meetings. There was a step study. There was a sharing meeting. There was an Altine meeting, and there was a meeting. The first time I went there, I just went in the first room. There's a meeting in every room down through this classroom building. And I turned in the first one, and as the meeting would sit, it was a little bigger than this. It'd probably sit about 60, 70 people with students with desks. And the guy opens up the meeting. He says, he announces the meeting. He says, "This is a crosstalk meeting." I said, "Okay, I've never heard of that. I wonder what a crosstalk meeting is." And what it meant was that he was a secretary, and he led every meeting. And every time anybody shared, he critiqued their share and told them what they ought to be doing. There were seven people in the room. I was there for several weeks working on a movie. I went back the next week, and I went past the first door to the second door, which was a step in tradition study. Now, you don't generally get big numbers in a step in tradition study, right? Standing room only. An ass in every chair. There were like lab benches along all the walls, people sitting up on the benches and sitting on the floor. And it was a meeting that did not allow crosstalk like the one back there. The only governing factor is who shows up. Bill Wilson said that the only authority in Alcoholics Anonymous is John Barleycorn. Willie alluded to this. The only authority, which is slang for whiskey, the only authority is whiskey. If we do it wrong, we will drink and we will die. It's the only real authority. Bill wasn't the authority. As a matter of fact, he shoved that off when he passed the traditions. Tradition 5. Each Al-Anon family group has but one purpose: to help families of alcoholics. We do this by practicing the 12 steps of AA ourselves, by encouraging and understanding our alcoholic relatives, and by welcoming and giving comfort to families of alcoholics. The AA version of it says each Alcoholics Anonymous group ought to be a spiritual entity having but one primary purpose, that of carrying its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. And from past to recovery, it says all Al-Anon, all members of Al-Anon, and I'm going to put in parentheses, and members of the family, need to feel welcome and a part of the group. Remember, full citizenship. Sometimes we have to remind ourselves to focus on recovery and to include each person in the circle, or to invite them to coffee after the meeting. That's Al-Anon Path to Recovery, page 176. We have but one purpose. My primary purpose in my home is to honor and be of service to the family and the people in it. It is not my family. It is not my marriage. It's God's. I used to talk about her when I'd talk to my sponsor. I had a woman sponsor. And I'd say, "Well, that wife did this and she did that, blah, blah, blah." And she said, "You know, she has a name." I thought, well, that was kind of rude. She's my wife. Of course she has a name. And she says, "Well, I think you should call her by her name." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because calling her by that title implies some form of ownership and or power." And from that day to this, and Willie had testified to this, first time I sat down at coffee with Willie and we were talking, I referred to her as my beautiful wife, Leslie. I've been calling her that for a little over 30 years. Willie will tell you that he was attracted to that idea and it actually changed his trajectory in life. That she's got a title, she's got a name. She might have a title and a name, but she's got a name. And so it doesn't infer any power or influence by me. That's my beautiful wife, Leslie. Tradition 6, Al-Anon family groups ought never endorse financial lender named any outside entity, blah, blah, blah. Although we are a separate entity, we always cooperate with Alcoholics Anonymous. It says down here, the pressure to conform to others' beliefs and ideas has been replaced by the ability to believe that other people's opinions of me really are none of my business. Somebody told me in a meeting, I was whining to my sponsor or somebody else, and they said, there will come a day when this is before this happened. They said, there will come a day when what somebody thinks of you be none of your business. I can't imagine, I'm new, I can't imagine that's even remotely possible. Of course it's my business. My entire identity is locked up in what you think of me. I need to do for you. I need to impress you. You need to think I'm something, because I'm not okay in here. I'm going to tell you flat out prior to the inventory process, I am not okay in here. And I'm scared to death that you're going to figure it out. So your opinion of me is everything. So they might as well have been speaking Latin. And then came the day I'm referring to here, which is they took it up a notch and they said, there'll come a day when what your wife thinks of you is none of your business. I went right to Latin again. I cannot wrap my mind around that. Of course, that's my business. There'll come a day when what your children think of you as none of your business. When you're doing that common welfare thing, when I dropped that little girl off when she was stealing from the house, I took her to All of You Hospital, to the psych ER. Do you know they have psych ER separate from the regular ER? That's where they take you if you're naked, directing traffic, and singing show tunes. They got a place for you over there. And it's like midnight on a Friday night, and I dropped her in the parking lot, and there was no anger in my voice. I said, just, honey, you can't be here anymore and do what you're doing. And I dropped her in that lot, and she said, Daddy, what do I do? I said, honey, if you don't want to sleep on the street tonight, you tell them what you told me, that you're thinking of taking your own life, because she had said that to me. I said, you'll get a bed tonight. And she did. They put her in a series of places, and then she wound up on the street. That's the application of that first tradition in a real postgraduate way. And it was no yelling and no screaming. She still thought I was, when I dropped her off, she still thought I was a great dad. How about that? But I will also tell you, I went home and cried myself to sleep every night for a long time. And when news of what was happening to her on the street came back, because it did, I wish it hadn't, the crime would start all over again. But it was the only way that I could, you know, as a family, we have to consider that common welfare. Tradition 7. Did you all know that I'm an Al-Anon sex symbol? The women in Al-Anon told me I was a sex symbol. I was at my Saturday morning meeting. This woman walked up to me, my friend Mindy C. Mindy said, did you know that you're a sex symbol in Al-Anon? I said, well, no. She said, would you like to know how that happened? I said, yeah, kind of would. She said, we were talking about the seventh tradition in the meeting, and you said that when you took off your clothes at the end of the day or after work and you chucked them at the hamper, if they missed or hit the wall behind and slid down behind, you were self-supporting. You went over and you picked up those clothes and put them in the hamper. That wasn't her mess to clean up. That was your mess to clean up. And she says, at that precise moment, you became a sex symbol in Al-Anon family groups. Self-supporting means more than just money, right? What does it mean in the meeting? It's more than the buck in the basket. It means you're taking a commitment. Jobs come up, you know. And when I was pretty new, for the first 10 or 12 years, we had our service board, the LA Intergroup Service Board. It's got 12 seated members and a chairman and blah, blah, blah. And we would have elections, and there'd be 18 people run. And 12 would get selected, and the other 7 or 5 or whatever, 6 would be alternates. They were on the board, too. We gave them jobs, put them on committees. Everybody worked. I can't remember the last time that they had a full slate of candidates to fill the empty positions on our AIS. Something fundamentally has changed, and I don't get it. My life depended on my being saying, yeah, okay, I'm not qualified, but I'll go do whatever you tell me to do. And I went down there and did that stuff. In your home is something else, right? It's not just the money thing. I provide the money to the family. My wife has been disabled for more than 30 years. But we're talking about everybody participating and being of service in the family is the way you honor the seventh tradition. And, you know, I have to be self-supporting in all those areas. How about emotionally? How about the day when you come home and it's a bad day for a hug? Remember those? I come through the door and ready to see my girl, and I'd hit the kitchen and she's in the Karate Kid stance. And there was a time when I really took that personal, right? After I understood this concept and this idea, it just became a bad day for a hug. See, I've got this resource now in meetings and with a sponsor and with my network of support people that if I need emotional support, I don't make her 100% responsible for it. By doing that, I make her responsible for my happiness, for my success and failure. I have to be willing to be self-supporting. There came a time many years ago when she got really sick, and I thought she was going to die. Yeah, we both thought she was going to die. Matter of fact, we weren't even talking about it because we knew the jig was up. She wasn't eating solid food, and it was really bad. And I was sitting in my living room thinking about it. I thought, if she dies, I'm going to close all these drapes. I'm going to lay right down there on the floor, and I'm just not going to get up because what's the use? I got no reason to get off the floor. The next thought was, you sponsor all of those bozos and Al-Anon, and you got a sponsor. You know damn well they're going to come kick the door down and pick you up and dust you off and drag your ass to a meeting, so why bother? Because I have this emotional support network safety pad is always there. When I had major surgery, they rebuilt my colon, right? I'm home hiding out. I'm sitting on a pink inflatable whoopee cushion. I am not going out in public with this thing. Thank you very much. Besides, I can't be more than 20 minutes between sitz baths. They tore me up. It was pretty bad. And one Saturday, there's a knock on my door, and my wife opens it up, and she says, "Honey, you've got company." And I said, I'm like on a couch. I can't even get up. And here comes Willie and all of his sponsees to bring a meeting to my house, uninvited. Yeah. He knew full well if he called me and said, "I'm bringing you a meeting," I'd have told him, no, it's not. I'll be fine. I don't want anybody to see me like that. They made a circle around me on the couch, and I was not looking at my very best. Me and my pink whoopee cushion, they brought me a meeting. Right? I'm supported in many areas. Tradition 8, Al-Anon 12-step work should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. I do not require payment in any form for my duties to my family or in my home. How many of you operate on the point system? That doing the dishes equals sex. That was my favorite one. Doing dishes equals sex. Doing the laundry equals special sex. Doing the laundry and putting it away equals special sex in public. God, see you laughing. That's hitting a nerve over here. It's the old point system from the disease, right? I'm ahead on points. I've got the moral high ground every day. I need to have an advantage. It's that dance around power that I talked about, right? And it can't be about power and be a success. I've never seen one that was based on power that had the longevity that mine has had. If I do something, are the strings attached? You bring your girl home flowers? Big thing of flowers, maybe tomorrow for Mother's Day, bring her some flowers, and then she doesn't pay attention to you. Maybe she turns you down for sex later. You get your feelings hurt? Mm-hmm. Does your ego get involved? Mm-hmm. Right, that's because it was not a gift. It was a manipulation tied up in a very pretty little bow. Mm-hmm. If I have anything attached to something that I do that's being of service or that's a kindness to another one, and I have an expectation that I used to do for my dad all the time. He'd get thrown out of his house. He'd run out of money. I'd lend him money. I'd buy his trailer and then give it back to him on his birthday. We did that dance for many years. And I did it so that he would not throw me away. I did it so he would like me and love me and so I could be a part of his life, right? All those things sound like a nice thing to do for somebody, but it was not. It was a manipulation. I was trying to gain an advantage. It says in here, in our path to recovery, Because one of our chief defects is a tendency to control in order to be safe, Tradition 9 is excellent counsel. Tradition 10. The Al-Anon family groups have no opinion on outside issues, hence our name ought never be drawn into public controversy. I never, ever, ever discuss politics with my sponsor. He's woefully naive about politics, so we don't talk about it. No, the reality is that doesn't have a place in my relationship with him. I will tell you, as a matter of fact, that my wife and I, we read the paper every day, we watch the news every day, we're up to speed on politics and world events. I learned to do that in the service, and it just became ingrained in me. To this day, at every single election, my wife has no idea how I voted. She'll ask me, "Who'd you vote for?" None of your business. What do you mean? No, you're my husband. You got to tell me. We're united front. Her vote doesn't cancel my vote. To this day, my wife has no idea who I voted for. She's got an idea based on the nature of our conversations about politics and world stuff, but she doesn't know for sure, and I've never told her. Wow. And I don't know how she's voted because I never ask her how she's voted. Let's go to Tradition 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, TV, and films. We need guard with special care the anonymity of all AA members. My son got sober. The first time he got sober, he took a little break in the middle, but the first time he got sober, like, could have knocked me over with a feather. We've been doing the dance around his alcoholism for a long time. Homeless on the street, wants and warrants in 7 states. If you bail bondsmen that would like to know where they might find him for a chat, he was creating a lot of wreckage out there, and he finally got sober in AA. And what it did for us is it gave us a common language we'd never had before, right? We talked all the time on the phone, but he'd be drunk telling me his troubles, and I never said, do you think it's because you're drunk? I never said that to him, ever, because of you and because I suffer from really good sponsorship. And he came down to visit, and he came to our meeting on a Thursday night. We were in the room before this room, back in the back, that had the little glass windows. And he's sitting in there, and we're on step and tradition night. And we're studying step 11 and tradition 11. And at first we do step 11 for half an hour, then we switch to the traditions. And they start out, and somebody shared on the steps, and my son put his hand up. He had I don't know, a couple of months of sobriety. Put his hand up to share, and I thought, uh-oh. He's going to embarrass me, right? And he said, I'd like to share about the 11th tradition. I thought, oh, shit, the kid's got it all wrong already. We're talking about the step, and he means to say the step, and he said the tradition. And he said, if it wasn't for the idea of attraction, of attraction rather than promotion, I would be dead today. If my parents had not absolutely, completely firewalled themselves from me and my alcoholism, had ever ventured any opinion or observation about my drinking, I would not be alive and sober today. I am not in the habit of crying on step and tradition night, but I bawled like a baby that night. Because what he was saying is, if I'd have done anything whatsoever to try and help him along towards what I desperately wanted for his goal, he could have died of his alcoholism, right? That's pretty powerful stuff in your home. It says here, and this is a spoiler alert too, it says, Bill Wilson eventually came to believe that anonymity equated with humility, often linking the return of ego, the return to drink. He frequently used the term big shotism. Step 12 says, or tradition 12, I'm doing my son's trick. Tradition 12 says, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles above personalities. When you read through those other 11 traditions, do you see anonymity in there? When you read about it in our 12 and 12, do you see anonymity in there? You don't find it in EAA 12 and 12 either. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. I was really confused about that. But because I'm an avid reader and historian, and I've done a lot of research on the history of Al-Anon and AA, I came to realize after reading an awful lot of stuff that Bill wrote that Bill absolutely, totally equated the word anonymity with the word humility. If you say that humility is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, you will find elements of humility in every single tradition. Bill thought if you use the same word to describe something, he was a crappy writer. So he always used different terminology, and in his mind it meant the same thing, humility, right? Our common welfare, humility, it's not about me. But one authority, humility, conscience of the group, how God expresses himself through the conscience of the group. Completely, totally self-supporting, humility. I don't make my wife responsible for my happiness. She makes me very happy, but I don't make her responsible for my happiness. If you go back and think about it, humility is shot through all of these. When I stay focused on the principle, I find that few things can affect my self-image and self-esteem. I will tell you that as a result of this, and I alluded to it before, and then I'll wrap up, that what happened when we began to apply these traditions, believe me, the steps are exceptionally important, but these traditions are what I'm talking about tonight in terms of quality of life and quality of my relationships. My alcoholic daughter, who has got, if she's not drunk today, has got 7 days of sobriety. She's living at home with us. She's working, and she'll get a couple of days, and she'll get drunk again. You ask my son, who went on the street. He's got 12 years of sobriety in North Florida now. He got sober in jail in Nebraska, which is another story. My little girl, who's in a group home, who suffers from severe emotional and mental disorders. If you ask any of the three of them, or you ask my wife, if I'm a good husband or I'm a good father, they'll tell you I'm the best in the world. That those ideas that, you know, getting everybody the right size in the house has created a circumstance where there's no ill feelings when I took that little girl and dropped her off at the ER. There was no ill feelings with my son when he called me from jail on his last run and said, Dad, I finally got a job after all these years so I can feed your grandsons, and I'm going to lose it in the morning if you don't send me a if you don't bail me out. Can you bail me out? And I said, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Even that day, my son will tell you I was a really good dad, and I was not a good dad when I got here. I used to hate people that were good dads because I hated that they could do it and I couldn't figure out how. My drunken son was a better father to my grandsons than I was to him. I didn't know how. I didn't know that applying these ideas, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions, was going to change me to the point where I'm an absolutely terrific father and I'm a terrific husband. I'm a terrific partner with my wife in advocating for that little girl who's got mental problems. We've gotten her. We have fought giants along the way, but because we're a united front based on these traditions, we prevailed. We got her the education. We got her places to go. We got her treatment. She's doing just fine. She'll be at our house tomorrow for Mother's Day. I'll tell you a quick story and I'll wrap up, and it's about the importance of these traditions. There's a guy, a historical guy, and you will not find him in the AA history books. You won't find him in any of those places. You will only find him if you're looking. You will find him if you look through the evangelical websites. You'll find this character there. And the guy was, his name was Orville Gardner. Orville was a boxer in the early 1800s. If you're a boxer, you got to have a nickname. Orville's nickname was Awful. Orville Awful Gardner. He got that nickname because he was observed by the press in a fight. He got mad and bit another opponent's ear off or his nose. There's some debate about that. He did that long before Mike Tyson made it popular because he was drunk and angry. And there, you know, some of the fights were in the ring. They were prize fights. And some of them were go down to the corner and let's duke it out until somebody's dead or gives up or they're unconscious. That's the kind of prize fighting he did. He wound up in a Sing Sing prison. Orville Gardner had a white light spiritual experience, probably around 1835 or 40, and sobered never to drink again. Bill Wilson didn't have his until 1934. Right. Bill wasn't the first one by a long shot. And he began carrying the message to other people in prison. There's a bunch of characters who went off to carry that message that wound up overlapping Bill and the early Oxford groups and the Calvary Mission in New York City. There's elements of that that intersected. So Orville gets out of jail and he feels strongly about carrying the message. In this case, it was the evangelical message of spiritual conversion. And he forms a club in New York called the Drunkards Club. Now, he didn't name it that. He named it, it was like a tea room, a reading and tea room, but it was only for alcoholics. He'd drag alcoholics in there trying to stay sober, and the alcoholics dubbed it the Drunkards Club, right? The membership of the Drunkards Club in 1840 New York began to swell based on the strength of the personality and the story of Orville Gardner. You drag a new guy into the Drunkards Club, and he'd say, I wouldn't have drank with any of these weenies. And then you see Orville, who's got cauliflower everything, who's got this incredibly compelling story of deprivation and conversion in prison and carrying the message. And they go, wow, if that guy could do that, maybe I could do that. On the strength of Orville Gardner's personality, the membership in the Drunkards Club swelled to almost 700 sober members. I don't remember the exact year, but it was around 1840. At some point after they'd been around for a little while, Orville got sick. Doctor said, if you don't want to die, you need to move to the country. Might have been consumption. I don't recall. And Orville Gardner moved away. And the membership of that club quickly dwindled and died. The club closed. And if you believe that alcoholism is progressive and fatal, like I believe, then it's not much of a stretch to understand what probably happened to those 700 alcoholics in New York City, because they had a program of recovery based on a personality instead of a set of principles. That's how important these things are to us. I hope we never forget them. Thank you guys for asking me. I did all of that without a tie. Yeah.